You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partnow of The Athletic, of Stats Bomb, of The Mid-Range Theory, his awesome book, of the Nerder She Wrote podcast, and we spend about 45 minutes going through game one of the NBA Finals, the fourth quarter, the adjustments each team can make, how the game shifted over the course of it, what the Warriors did well, what the Celtics did well, tactical adjustments, so many fascinating, fun wrinkles for this consequential series. And episode is brought to you by BetOnline. Use that CLNS50 promo code, tell them you came from us, and I hope you really enjoy this episode. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Anything going on in the basketball world that we should talk about?
Making East Coasters stay up super late to watch finals games. I guess that's a part of it. And we're recording this the morning after game one, and you and I are both going to spend a lot of time talking about not only this game but the other ones on our other podcasting things as well. And what I wanted to start with you, since I've already talked with Nate about this a bunch, is do you take more from the dominance that the Celtics showed in kind of the phases of the fourth quarter, or do you take more from quarters one through three?
I mean, really, it's you know, the first half was very even. The third quarter was third quarter Warriors, and the fourth quarter was third quarter Warriors the other way. So there's a lot of this weird kind of segmenting going on about, well, this part of the game we were good and that's all that counts. And, mm-hmm. and I don't buy that. I think that, you know, based on the evidence of one game, this is going to be a good series between two closely matched teams. And probably the final margin of the game reflected Boston having just over the course of the game, you know, a slight but not enormous edge, I don't think, in shot making. They made a few more baskets, I guess, is another way of saying it, which, like, duh. But yeah, so I don't know. I think I almost want to get more micro about some of the things that would be worrying for me for either team.
I think one place to start with that is the non-Curry minutes. And so there will be a stretch in each half when Stephen Curry is not on the floor. And it has been a difficulty for Golden State every single year because the Warriors have never had an above average offense when Curry has been off the floor. And they, you know, it's hard to have that when your best player is not there, especially when you run a scheme much of the time that it kind of depends on that. And there have been these different ideas, both in the regular season and in the playoffs, of, well, how can you do better there? And I was thinking about it. I was talking about it yesterday because that's really in the fourth quarter. That was where the run started. But I thought, you know, going into the micro, to me, the offensive process, like generating advantages when Curry was off the floor in the second quarter, was also flawed, because mostly because they just don't have personnel and they just hit some tough shots. Otto Porter was 4 of 5 from three. A lot of those were during that stretch. Iguodala had some finishes. And one way to solve that is just to have fewer of those minutes. But because the Warriors don't have this many dominant offensive players, I don't know that there is a fix, per se.
And also, given how Boston is as equipped to just get into Steph on his dribble as any team in the league, I thought in particular Derek White in the second half did a really good job of just, you know, making it tough on Curry off the bounce, fourth quarter especially. But saying, okay, Steph, you know, have the ball in your hands, you know, be a heliocentric creator for you know, now we got asking you to do for 38 minutes a game. I think that shows up in his legs in games 5, 6, 7. And so I would be worried about that. But on the flip side, like where does the offense get generated when he's off the floor? You don't want to overreact to one game sample, but Jordan Poole ain't it. Clay is, I don't think Clay, you can count on to be that guy. And something I think we'll come on to in greater detail, but Draymond's offense is a problem for them. Like, I don't know if there's any other way to put it. I think that is going to be a problem for Golden State this series, unless, you know, something changes, over what we saw in game one and have really kind of seen throughout the playoffs.
Right. And Draymond, there were points in this, you know, like game one, you think of, and I mean, this was definitely present in the first quarter, as adjusting and the Celtics and the Warriors learning what the other team does and understanding the vast differences between their current opponent and their most recent opponent. And there are a lot of those for both of these teams on each end of the floor. And you get the growing pains from that. And the Warriors in particular, because their offense is very different than Miami's, we knew that there were going to be some, but there were also just some Celtics flubs. But something that Boston did really well for a game one, I like to use the general term threat assessment for this, is understanding, playing the overall odds of who is going to beat you and where. And so they knew that Andre Iguodala was a very reluctant shooter and often a reluctant finisher if there's anyone remotely present. And with Draymond, it was largely, you know, kind of a story in that vein. Draymond Green in the game, and the Warriors, you know, Chase Center, the Chase Center log person, you might know their exact job title, is notoriously bad at distinguishing between restricted area and floater range. So I just say paint for everything when a game is played at Chase Center. Draymond Green, 2 of 8 in the paint during this game. And the Celtics understood if they get a late contest, if they get something there, then that's probably good enough. And so when you can give ground to Iguodala, Draymond Green, and Kevon Looney when he doesn't have an offensive rebound, it constricts everything else.
And there's, I don't know, there's very different interpretations. There's a few possessions. I noticed one in particular in the fourth quarter where if you're watching out of your peripheral vision, it looks like great offense, but if you really focus on it, it's actually not producing anything. There was at least one play in the fourth quarter where it was like Steph drove and kicked the ball to a wide open Draymond in the corner who zipped the extra pass to Iguodala in the slot. And then Iggy just kind of dribbled around. And like, we dribbled fast, but just like, wow, it's a great ball movement. And look at all the openings they're creating and getting nothing out of it. Like, and so it's, you know, it has the almost the appearance of, you know, drive, kick, swing, swing. Hey, that's what good NBA offense looks like right now. But then if you look and see, wait, it's a non-threat in that spot, throwing the ball to another non-threat in that spot and burning 8 seconds and getting the ball out of Steph's hands. That seems pretty good for Boston, especially it means like Rob Williams is still just kind of menacing everything near the basket instead of really worried about either of those two players.
It also led to a fascinating parallel between this series and the original conceit from Jason Kidd in the Western Conference Finals, which was the idea of keep somebody on Steph, keep somebody on Clay, and kind of work from there. But what the Celtics don't have to do, and I mean, I would say that the Mavericks didn't trust those guys enough, like Bullock and DFS in particular, is you can do that philosophically, but really what that means is that doesn't mean sending extra defenders at those players in opportunities. What it means is set somebody on them and help off of others. And they're generally, you know, unless they're going to play Curry, Poole, and Thompson together, and that opens up other limitations, you can do that. And what you are sacrificing is tolerable. And you're playing the overall numbers game. There will be a point where Draymond Green hits 2 out of 4 threes, and it will look better for the Golden State Warriors. But those, you know, you're working like as a defense. You're not trying to play the, you know, the possession by possession math. You're trying to play the quarter by quarter math. And the Warriors are going to have those situations. And a big reason why that's possible is because Boston has defenders good enough that you can say, I want to put player X on Klay Thompson, and you could actually think Klay Thompson's not going to get that open.
I mean, this is maybe a somewhat of an indication that Thompson really is not all the way back physically. Is like Grant Williams had some success chasing Klay Thompson around screens.
Grant Williams, like, who did not have any success on Stephen Curry, but did on Klay at times.
And you know, I I said this on my podcast last night. I'll say it again. Like, it's fair to say you would not have found a bigger Grant Williams fan pre-draft than me. And if you'd have told me that, you know, hey, 4 years from now, he's going to be, you know, he's going to be blowing up floppy action, guarding Klay Thompson in the NBA Finals. Like, okay, what, where can I get some of that, please? That's, you know, that's that. But I mean, that was sort of a side note. The worrying problem is it seems like Boston is, you know, once they sort of got over in the first half, almost the initial, oh, these guys don't run the same stuff as Miami. These guys don't run this stuff, actually. They just kind of read and react. And once they kind of got velocitated to that almost, it really seemed like for the most part, they made life difficult for the Warriors. Third quarter was, again, as often the case with Boston, I feel like a lot of the Golden State's offensive success was predicated on Boston's own bad offense. Mm-hmm. You know, giving Steph a broken floor, but to work with, basically. And you know, obviously, that's sort of the feedback loop of Boston making shots in the fourth quarter meant that didn't happen.
Right. Yeah, they were able to short circuit it. And the Golden State Warriors in game one, clean the glass, first shot, half court offensive rating, 90.1.
That's fine. I mean, that's
better, basically better than most of the teams had in the Celtics Bucks series. But yeah, when Boston's at a 114, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But it is a reminder that, you know, like the stuff, the broken floor, as you mentioned, when the Warriors got out in transition, and a lot of success off of offensive rebounds, which, you know, that is its own thing. And, you know, I thought that was going to be an important factor in the series, considering Boston has conceded those and the Warriors have become this much better. They've been a much more aggressive offensive rebounding team in these playoffs.
Yeah, no, and I mean, just talking about this, like, who Golden State, who Kerr decides to play is going to be fascinating. Like, how many minutes can Otto Porter play? Because they need every single one of them. Gary Payton can't come back soon enough. I don't – can Iggy be on the floor? Like, he had a – there was one stretch where they kind of used him as a screener in pick and roll, and it was effective. But as soon as Boston got, like, Rob Williams out of that action, it stopped being effective. So, like, does he bring enough it's one of those things where it's like, you know, the line between something being an option and a difficult choice, it can kind of changes series by series. And if there's one kind of thing that I take away from that from you know, Golden State standpoint, it's there's a lot of difficult choices to be made there.
There are. I mean, it doesn't necessarily help the spacing issues, but just to have some general athleticism, trying out Kuminga at some point could be useful. I mean, he just brings something a little bit different. Bielitsa, like, because he can capably shoot and move the ball. I'm not saying in, like, the best of the best lineups. But also, like, I wonder how each of... And I think we saw more of it from Udoka than Kerr in game one, plenty of time to adjust, is how you handle the ebbs and flows from these games that happen when the best players are and are not on the floor. Like, Stephen Curry's rest, maybe not the duration, but the timing of it is very predictable. And each team can hone their rotations to put whatever they want out there. And, you know, so that can be, for the Celtics, one part of that is just making sure that Derek White and or Marcus Smart is out there to shut down a lot of what Jordan Poole wants to do. You have two very good guys at accomplishing that goal. I would say that Robert Williams should probably be out there a fair amount in those lineups. You can, as you mentioned, keeping him out of the actions if they're doing some of the stuff with Iguodala. And for the Warriors, how they want to handle that in the Brown, no Tatum minutes, like, are there specific defenders that you think are better suited for those minutes in certain...
Porter.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, it's like, there's a couple times where, like, Klay hasn't... I think it was it Nate who's... I was listening to you guys, and Nate said something like, yeah, I think Klay can hold up on Jaylen Brown. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
I thought I said that Klay would have trouble because he's always, yeah, he's in the this vintage of Klay has had trouble with speed guys, not power guys.
Or maybe he said that Klay can hold up on Tatum, and I don't.
Yeah, that's what he said. That's what
I don't really buy that either. But he's got no chance against Jaylen Brown.
Well, that's what led to this weird thought that I had on the pod, on our preview pod, talking about how in some ways Klay, so I thought when Klay came back, you know, like in the abstract, we're dealing with 2 years where he didn't play, that he was going to come back as a three. And in some ways, defensively, he's more of a four now, just because the guys he can stick with and who he has some trouble with.
I mean, yeah.
And also, he's still recovering, of course.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, each of those is a 2-year injury. And so this is year 2 of the Achilles. And so, like, maybe next year. But it's also, I mean, zooming out, like, the 18-19 season. It's 1 year and you don't want to read too much into it, but there was a pretty big decline in his defensive numbers that year. And like in 1 year, it's like, okay, this is a team that's made 4 straight finals and is kind of coasting through the regular season. And like the on off stuff with those Warriors teams is weird anyway, because like, you know, is he getting penalized for not being Andre Iguodala kind of thing? But that was a year where it's like, like Klay's been a pretty good defender, but this year his impact numbers were bad. And his defensive impact numbers this year were bad. And that's like, you know, obviously coming back from the injury and sort of the timing of it, you know, coinciding with Draymond being out. So there's a lot of kind of statistical weirdness there. But at the same time, he's into his 30s. And like, so there would be some expected defensive decline plus 2 major injuries. And now you're asking him to guard like 2 of the more dynamic wings in the league. And it's, I don't think it shouldn't be surprising that that's a problem.
Right. And that gets into what I think is, after the first 6 minutes of the fourth quarter, an essential question for the Warriors moving forward is, who do they trust on Jaylen Brown defensively the rest of this series?
Part of that is it's like you also kind of, some of the shots Jaylen Brown hit last night, you're like, okay, fine. You know,
it was also one of the best playmaking stretches I've seen from him ever.
And so it's, you do want, I mean, they do need someone who can, I don't know if need is the right, but I think we've seen that, you know, someone who can like, you know, hold him up physically a little bit. And then the fact that he has struggled to handle the ball in any sort of traffic, is that fair to say? That can come into play. But sure. Like Klay can't do that.
No, I have 2 guys.
Draymond and Porter, right?
No, Wiggins and Gary Payton the second. Because Gary Payton, if he becomes available, and he'll be limited offensively with this elbow injury, he can get into Jaylen's handle. It'll actually be similar. Jaylen Brown had a ton of trouble driving on Victor Oladipo in the Eastern Conference Finals because his handle isn't tight enough to prevent that aggressive hands guy.
And can get in a guy who's, and it's almost a benefit to be shorter because you can kind of get low and get leverage on him, and then, you know, kind of hold him up and then use the length to kind of poke away the high semi-controlled dribble that Jaylen can go to sometimes.
Exactly. And Wiggins, it's more just that he can move his feet pretty well. Like Porter, his quickness isn't as much of a problem, but he has trouble defending in space. Like that's just not, you know, where he is at this. I think he can do an okay job. Like he would be a reliable option. And with Draymond, I think that if your goal is to stop him one-on-one, so like in the non-Tatum minutes, yeah, I think you could go to that reasonably well. It does present these problems, and it's the same thing when you throw good defenders on Jason Tatum, which is part of why that intriguing Jordan Poole guarding Tatum in a box and one thing like actually has some conceptual merit is
especially a game where Tatum like is offensively kind of at sea.
Yes, as a scorer. And yeah. I think that, but so the idea behind some of that stuff going, you know, hearkening back to the Eastern Conference Finals is when you have one of your best help defenders, one of your best rim protectors on a primarily perimeter player.
Is this the Giannis should guard KD argument again?
It's the reverse. It is that you lose them in all of these other elements.
Yeah.
And Jaylen Brown, other than in the non-Tatum minutes, he doesn't have to be in all of these acts. The Celtics have, it's part of why the Derek White acquisition was so important. They have other players who can initiate offense. And so if you want, if putting Draymond Green, particularly if it happens to be minutes that Looney's not on the floor, if you're going to commit him to shutting down Jaylen Brown, going back to those years when the Warriors played the Rockets and they had him guarding Ryan Anderson for stretches of games, it's like, oh, so Draymond Green's just going to be useless at the basket now.
The way Boston, especially if you kind of keep those two guys from getting sort of initial advantages, the way Boston's offense can kind of break down.
Sure. Like, that's a good point.
I do wonder if like that, you know, when they get rolling, the ball kind of can zip around. But when you make those two guys play in the mud, it gets very stagnant.
They have a higher level of inertia than some other teams do.
Yeah. Like I think we saw this for long stretches of kind of the late first and early second quarter where Boston's offense was just sort of dribbling around the top of the arc and never really getting the ball, you know, it never really cracking Golden State's shell. Like Golden State was it almost looked like Golden State was playing a matchup zone just because there's like five guys sort of semi-sagging off and freely passing guys off around the perimeter and no advantage being created. If you can get them into that by having Draymond stopping penetration, then you don't need him as a help defender.
That's a fair point. Plenty more with Seth Partnow, but first a message from BetOnline.ag. Our partners at BetOnline continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports information. Find all the latest odds, news, and sports developments, including this year's NBA Finals, as you're hearing on this podcast, the NHL Hockey Conference Finals, Major League Baseball scores, all the latest fighting news, and even next season's early NFL futures. BetOnline is your continued source for all of your sports wagering information, from live betting to playoffs, esports, and more. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Just use our promo code CLNS50 to get the bonus and get into the action. And plus, it tells them you came from us, which we really appreciate. So check it out at BetOnline, where the game starts.
Can we talk about Tatum?
Sure.
It's a really weird performance. His playmaking has gotten a lot of praise, and you know, some there were moments certainly, but I thought he like it was a very strange performance from him. I mean, there was started from like the second play of the game almost. It's like he seemed like he was struggling to get his feet right on the catch a lot of times. Like he almost seemed like he was on skates at times out there.
There was also kind of connecting with that some strangeness in terms of him figuring out how and when to attack when an inferior defender just starts the possession on him. You don't have to create the mismatch and go. And he actually could have used some of what Jaylen Brown, you know, call it the Gabe Vincent playbook now, where it's like, oh, I have this guy on me. I'm just going to go right now. I'm going to, you know, maybe take a jab step or a couple dribbles and do a pull up. It isn't, you know, sometimes the advantage is just what you have. And you work through it. Yeah. And so that, like, so there were plays where Jason Tatum was being guarded after like a switch. This was, I think it was like the 8 minute mark of the first quarter, being guarded by Stephen Curry. And he's like kind of doing this hesitation and kind of getting into stuff. It's like, you have Stephen Curry on you. Just shoot over him.
Yeah.
Like, you're much bigger than he is. And so those, I don't know if that's that he wasn't feeling quite right and just didn't think he had that. But I mean, Jason Tatum making tough shots, these aren't even nearly as tough as some of the ones that he does well.
No, it almost seemed like he went too far in terms of, all right, it's my first finals game. I'm going to let the game come to me. I'm not going to try to, you know, take over the moment. And it seems like he almost went too far that way. Like there was, this is, you know, you compare him to someone like, I don't know, James Harden. And he's one of the things he's much better at is, oh, I'm open. I caught the ball. I'm open. I'll shoot. I don't need to, you know, get into anything. But it seemed like he was almost wanted to get into doing, you know, making a good play instead of just making the play that was there. And, you know, it's a tough balance. Like, I think we saw latter half of the finals last year. I think we saw Devin Booker kind of tip over to the other side of that line and like be too try to, you know, take, you know, they're showing me this defensive look. So I'm going to take the game by the scruff of the neck and almost like throws his teammates out of the offense despite getting good stuff himself. And so it's a tough balance. I don't want to, you know, but it did seem like he erred way too much on the side of patience.
I think that's totally reasonable. And go ahead.
No, there was one stretch in the second quarter where even though it didn't always result in stuff, it at least got him in some good situations where you noted like they would run like, you know, I think it was mostly like Tatum smart pick and rolls. With smart handling and Golden State would switch, and this is something that Boston has done basically since, you know, Tatum's rookie year. They did this against us in the playoffs in 2018. Was you get that the small switch on him, and instead of like doing anything else, he would just like slip or dive right into a post up. And I thought that, you know, again, they didn't always get great stuff out of that. Like, and one of them ended up with Smart hitting a pretty ridiculous leaner with a toe on the line. But getting him into that advantage situation against Steph off of that was something that I was surprised they didn't go back to really the rest of the game. And that's something that I would almost look for them to to explore more later in the series, especially if they can get like, okay, Steph's on you, put him in the basket. Like you're posted up on Steph Curry, you know, 8 feet away from power dribble in the middle, turn around. Either someone's going to double and you can kick to the corner, or you just shoot a little, you know, 8 footer over him. So I would almost expect that to be something that Boston looks to go back to. And that'll be more effective in a game where Tatum is a little more on song.
Sort of along that line, I was, you know, thinking about the support players for the Celtics, and I you might have more familiarity with how the tracking data does this than I do, but so the way when I'm looked at it for the NBA site today, they have it classified that 36 of Boston's three-pointers, Boston attempted 41 in game one, were catch and shoot, so no dribble jump shots. And first of all, the denominator of that 36 shots is an absolute ton. Like that is a ton of catch and shoot opportunities. Generally, guys are going to do better on those. They're more likely to be open. And the Celtics made 19 of them. So 53% is a whole lot. And I thought that both parts of that were really telling.
So that's interesting, because I think if you actually broke that down and maybe did it a little finer and looked at like where, like the how open those shots were, and this is tough to do from public data, but and looked at it especially by quarter, I thought it's like early in the game, especially a lot of those were sort of like semi or contested wing jumpers kind of later in the shot clock after they didn't do anything to kind of crack Golden State's defense. Then you look in like the fourth quarter, and you like the number in the fourth quarter, the uncontested threes were I believe 6-1 in terms of attempts in favor of Boston. And you know, they made four of them, which is, you know, slightly more than you expect, but still, like that, I think that is reflective of the process that down the stretch there, where it's like, oh, you know, we're getting open corner threes for Marcus Smart and Peyton Pritchard and Al Horford. And yeah, okay, they made maybe one or two extra of them, but Golden State got one. They created one open, like, uncontested three in the fourth quarter, and I think it was for Draymond. Like, so, like, I mean, that is certainly indicative of a process advantage for Boston, I would say.
Right, and how much of that, you know, normally you would say, well, Steph Curry doesn't play the beginning of the fourth quarter. He only sat for, I believe it was like 2.5 minutes, because things went so haywire so quickly for the Golden State Warriors during that stretch. But generating good shots is a key determining factor in individual games of the series. And I agree with you. Like in that early stretch, you know, Marcus Smart hit some tough ones, and the Warriors were doing a good job, you know, making those shots hard. But I said Marcus Smart hit some tough ones. The Warriors also at some stretches, they kind of helped too aggressively too early, and I thought they did a better job of that later. But then they also the Celtics were creating bigger advantages, and it created tougher choices.
I think that's right.
Because you're watching on TV, what did you think about what they were calling for fouls and what they were not? I'll leave it as open as that, because it always feels different in the arena, especially when you're dealing with a whole crowd.
I honestly, the best thing I can say is I didn't notice the officiating last night.
Okay, that seems reasonable. So for me, what I noticed was, and this harkens back to points earlier in the season, it seemed to me, and this was more in the first half than the second, that they were letting a lot more contact go around the basket, and that is a way you can officiate. You know, that's, I'm not saying it's unreasonable.
Let's put it this way: coming off of the Eastern Conference Finals, like where, like, you know, it was like prefaced by saying it was a hard series to officiate. I thought the officiating was abysmal across that series. First of all, this game was like talking about physicality around the basket. Again, compared to that series, this was sparring rather than, you know, a championship fight. And I think there was three total free throws in the fourth quarter, but it didn't seem like there was a lot of, or really any sort of, oh, the whistle should have been blown there.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few like on Curry's drives where there was some contact, but I didn't think it, like, the disparity was between what was called and what should have been called was dramatic in any way. I thought it was more a story of these teams just not doing much to get fouled, as opposed to there being, you know, the refs holding the whistle and I think that's the way that I would describe it. Maybe a few, but again, it's in some ways that is like a It's less consistent than this, which is hilarious because of how inconsistent this is. But it's sort of, it can be sort of like the a strike zone in baseball where different referees think that different levels of contact are sufficient, and you get an understanding. In many ways, the functional ideal, not the actual ideal, is consistency once you've set the guidelines. And so,
yeah, no, I think consistency within a game is like that. You would ideally like it to be consistent game to game, but from experience, we know, you know, it's a different crew and a different game and a different environment, and who knows what happens early in the game. I thought it was completely consistent across the game.
Right. So it's like an umpire calling the same strike zone, even if it's not the box that the league says is what it should be.
Now, if you're
and it wasn't too far off, honestly. Yeah. Like, I'm not saying it was miles and miles away and they just had to deal with it. No, not at all.
I mean, if you're going to say that the more physicality that's allowed is probably advantage Boston, sure, I'll buy that. At the same time, like, you know, it's not like Draymond is averse to being in a continuous state of foul and daring, a continuous state of either personal or technical foul. And kind of daring the refs to call at all times. So I don't think the advantage is necessarily as clear. But I saw some stuff on Twitter about, oh my God, Steph is getting hammered. It's like, I didn't really notice it. And like, there was a lot of complaints about like the, I thought, pretty blatant push off that he got called for. It's like, oh, how dare they? Tatum does that every time, kind of thing. It's like, okay. You extend the arm, it's a foul. I don't know. These questions are literally the first time I've thought about the officiating in any detail about the game last night, which generally speaking is a pretty good sign for how the game was officiated.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Can we talk about some strategic stuff? And I think
I'd love to.
It feels like Kerr got, I don't want to say outfoxed a little bit, but a pretty key kind of couple sequence of the games were, you know, in the fourth quarter, Boston's making their run. Golden State calls two timeouts. They ran kind of a Spain throwback action out of both of them, and Boston had it perfectly scattered out both times, got steals both times, and got a Pritchard run out layup one time and a wide open trail 3-4 Horford the other time. And I thought those were pretty key moments in the game. It's like, oh, we call a timeout to stop a run, and then we give up, you know, quick, easy, high-value shots the other way directly out of our timeout both times.
Yeah, that was something I didn't think about live, but I believe you're completely correct. They had, it was Jaylen Brown steal leading to that run out, and then it was, Draymond threw one, and then that was, I think that was the Horford shot that put him up six.
Yeah, and that was the play where Iggy maybe had a layup, but there was a guy within arm's reach of him, so he decided to like lob a pitch back sort of towards the arc, and I think Brown was the one who picked that one off too, but I don't remember exactly. It might have been Smart, but still, it was like a kind of a wounded duck of a pass that got picked off, run back the other way, and then, you know, yeah, Horford stepped into the trail three to I don't want to say put it away, but really put Boston in control that they never really got away from. And Boston did, the other thing, Boston did a much better job closing the game on offense than they have done, and that, like, not just from a shot making standpoint, but from a process standpoint.
Yeah,
the
process to me is
offense.
Far more important in that respect. Yeah. Like they were generating, and Boston did something that I criticized them for so much on, like, you know, Nate, I did a lot of those games on playback, and we're talking about like it's taking them forever to get into their stuff, and a problem when you do that in a system that generally requires you to create the advantage and then maximize it is that takes time. You know, like that takes 6 to 8 seconds sometimes. And so if you don't get going, you know, with 14, 16 on the clock, then you're creating the advantage and you're in a late clock situation. So the advantage largely evaporates, and they were doing it earlier, and that made a huge difference.
Yeah, and some of that might just be like the fact that, you know, since Golden State plays with pace, there's already sort of pace in the game. So it's not where, you know, where against, you know, Miami and Milwaukee, where it's almost like, hey, let's turn it up to like 1.2 bars of gravity for this game. And it's like we're playing in a lighter atmosphere now, so we can move, we can bound around the court. I think that had a little something to do with it, just in terms of Boston's like kind of keeping with the pace of the game rather than kind of, well, this game is slow, so we should slow down.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of afflicted them for a lot of the Miami series, despite that being advantage heat.
I don't know if this counts as a tactical thing. I also spent a lot of time on this with Nate last night, but I always like going into a game one, kind of one of the things that you almost always learn is who can stick in this series and who can't. And you're playing a lot of different opponents. I mean, the wonderful extreme here is Steven Adams, who was unplayable against Minnesota and then was eminently playable against the Warriors because of what they do. And
I thought that like him being unplayable against Minnesota was a pretty drastic overreaction by...
He has trouble with Towns, I'll put it that way. I think they should have picked some spots for him in other circumstances. Yeah. But also Memphis has enough good players that they didn't have to... It's not like they're playing sub-rotation guys to shift it,
but,
which makes...
But I thought, like, I do, like, the difference between, like Steven Adams was much more playable in this series than I kind of, at the outset, was kind of thinking this might be an okay matchup for Daniel Theis. And now I do not think that anymore at all. And I think we didn't see him in the second half.
No.
I think that's sort of, you mentioned like bringing like Bielitsa into the game, like all of a sudden that, you know, Boston has, you know, seven guys they trust. And if you, am I forgetting someone?
I mean, Peyton Pritchard had a better...
Peyton Pritchard, yeah. So,
yeah, I mean, Pritchard being able to be on the floor pretty well, I thought that, you know, the Warriors didn't go after him that much, but I thought he held up and had some big play finishes. You know, they've kind of figured out the balance on Pritchard is that he's better at converting than he is at generating those openings, and they have other guys to generate those openings, so more power to him.
I also, he did a really nice job of navigating, like, guarding, whether it was Poole or Clay or even Steph, I think, once or twice in sort of the DHO action. Like, White, yes, is White is great at that. But, like, you know, Pritchard is, you know, you want to put him in that Grayson Allen box of, oh man, that's just not going to work. And he has gotten himself to the point where he can make himself small around that screen and can kind of side or rear view contest without fouling.
And it's about thresholds here. It's not about, you know, being tethered to the guy, being 2 feet away as you get through everything else. Not everybody can be Marcus Smart or like some of these expert screen navigators, but if you're close enough that it's not really generating much of an advantage, and especially honestly, if it's Clay, because if Clay has a half step and he can't make that as a three, then he might end up taking a bad shot anyway. And you know, Clay was, I think, 2 of 5 on mid-rangers in this game. And so, yeah, I thought Pritchard holding his own was potentially significant. And, you know, like Grant Williams on Stephen Curry was a surprise. I we talked about it earlier. That was a surprising problem, but there's still a place for him clearly in this series. And Derek White, I wasn't worried about this at all. Like, there wasn't a can Derek White play in the series. That's part of why you give up what they did to get Derek White, is that he's an extra player out of whole cloth that you have. And so for Boston, I think those early returns, not only with those guys, but Robert Williams and the rest certainly seem to help him, but this is not an every other day finals. So that will help him as well. I thought he totally held his own.
Yeah, no, I think, I'm of even slightly compromised. I'm fine if he ends up switched on Curry. It's not ideal, but I think I like that look better than kind of, you know, sort of the up to touch kind of semi trap that gives like Draymond or Iggy like the short roll.
For sure, especially because it ties up one of your best rim protectors. The Horford's probably available in those circumstances, but also the play, and the Celtics did such a better job in the second half pre-switching, getting Williams out of those actions when they could, not every time, but as much as they could. And having him out there is a big part of why the Warriors had trouble finishing around the basket, because he can be almost anywhere. And Robert Williams, part of what I love, I used to talk about this with Mitchell Robinson and to an extent Robert Williams. There are a few guys, and incidentally, Andre Drummond is an offensive rebounder, where one of the joys of watching games on League Pass is that you often get opposing announcers broadcasting a player that they don't see very often. And it's always the, like, how did he get there type of thing for Robert Williams, because he's less agile right now than he normally is, but he's also just incredibly long. And so the Warriors, sort of like the Memphis series, like the Memphis did a great job making sure that whenever you got around the basket, there was going to be somebody, and that somebody was probably not a small guy who wasn't going to affect your shot. And I thought it made a huge difference.
I mean, there was it's funny that even like visibly compromised, he's still just... The best example of this was there was like a ball got knocked around, and somehow it seemed like he dove from like the elbow and like laid out and like tipped the ball, like almost when the ball was almost at half court to, I believe, Tatum, who then like kind of came down and got like fouled by Draymond going for like a step through on a Euro step. And it was just like, you're not supposed to be able to cover that much ground in like one step. But especially when like you have a bad wheel. So yeah, no, he's even like the fact that he's this athletic, even like laboring is pretty impressive. I know we probably got a wrap soon, but we talk about Jordan Poole.
So defensively, we saw, Jordan Poole getting the Gabe Vincent treatment where Jalen Brown was just going after him.
That's not fair because Gabe Vincent is a massively bad
defender. Oh, yeah. I mean, anytime Jordan Poole is in an action, the other team is going to generate some sort of advantage, whether that isn't, that's not fair to Gabe Vincent. Gabe Vincent is miles, miles better of a defender than Poole. And Jordan Poole has had some really strong moments during these playoffs, but when teams have had the personnel and the discipline to defend him well, he doesn't unlock every door. He unlocks certain doors extremely well. So he'll play better, I think, in other games of the series, but will he have dominance? I don't know that he'll have dominant stretches.
So this is something that I got a lot of heat for saying this on Nerder as the playoffs were starting, is like, in the play-in last year, he kind of ran away from the ball for a lot of that game. And yeah, he hit a big shot at the end and he got the 3-shot foul that wasn't a foul that Taylor Jenkins should have challenged. But for vast stretches of the second half of that playoff game, he didn't want anything to do with the ball. And I think we saw that again last night. There's a play with about 3 minutes, the play where Steph tweaked his ankle a little bit. Like the ball swings to him in the slot and he's got a 2-on-1 and he just like freezes. He record scratches and then tries to like make the extra pass to Clay in the corner, but it gets tipped out of bounds. It's just like, if you're not going to shoot that or at least make a play off that, you can't be on the floor.
That's what you're asked to do.
Yeah.
Like it is essential, and how they balance that is going to be important. I know you have to leave soon.
This is almost a Mavericks problem in that this is something that I think the huge first quarter Steph can be a problem, because the rest of the Warriors do have a tendency to, Steph will figure it out. Clay will shoot, that's fine. But especially like, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to get off the ball and then Steph and Draymond and maybe Iggy will work something out and we'll get offense that way. And, if he's expended the energy to go big in the first half, can he do that down? There's going to be games where he goes for 50 and just like does that for four quarters. But this is something that sort of has happened with the Mavs at Luka at times, where he goes big in the first quarter and no one else really does anything. And then it's like, well, okay, Luka kind of has to not for a little bit. So who else is doing anything? And I think that down the stretch, the Warriors did suffer a little bit from that. Just sort of a reluctance to make a play by other people on the floor.
Yeah, it's a great point. I know you have to run quickly. Do you want to give a very brief, as long as you want, sales pitch for Sports Business Classroom?
That's it. Well, I before we started, say if you can think of a good segue, but we'll just toss that out the window and go no segue at all. This is the third year I've done it, teaching at Sports Business Classroom in Vegas during Summer League. It's put on by Larry Kuhn, guru of the salary cap. It's designed to both teach the skills and help people like build the network necessary to break into the basketball industry, whether that's trying to work on the team side, the media side, or we've had people come through and go work for agencies as well. The salary cap guru for Clutch, for example, came through SBC a number of years ago. So we make every effort possible to not just teach the skills, but really, it's a very, you hear it all the time, it's a relationship business. Just get real, meaningful interaction with people in these positions. So when the time comes, you're not cold calling someone, you're talking to someone who you know a little bit. And I've really enjoyed teaching there. I think a number of students from there have continued to be people I'm in contact with,
including dunked on interns who are now doing great things, who are doing great things for us, but are now doing them. You know, Liam and Ben doing great things elsewhere too.
Yeah, Dave Dufour,
Of course,
world traveler and podcaster extraordinaire. So I would just encourage, if that sounds interesting at all, get in touch with me on Twitter, go to the Sports Business Classroom website, and happy to tell you more.
I will let you go record another podcast, tell all of them hello, and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Danny. Take care.
Thanks again to Seth Partnow for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic. You can listen to the Nerder She Wrote podcast. You can also, and you should, buy his book, The Mid-Range Theory, which is available now. It is fantastic. I learned a lot from it, and I talk to Seth all the time, so it's amazing, and it's very readable as well. I've been blown away by what is. We'll probably have a longer conversation about it at some point on the pod. Of course, if you don't already, you can follow Seth on Twitter at SethPartnow. Love having him on, and I've already had two conversations, podcasts on game one, and probably won't have another one until game two, but there will be even more wrinkles to uncover, and game one surprised at a couple of different turns in terms of the matchups that teams were willing to do, like Stephen Curry guarding Jason Tatum, in the early part of game one, and the Poole box and one combo, which was very surprising, and Grant Williams having some trouble with Steph, and how these coaches adjust. These are incredibly talented teams that will have other things that they can do well, and I'm extremely excited to see where it goes. My expectation is still that this will be a long series, though I am significantly less confident that, significantly is overstating it. I'm less confident that the Warriors will win it than I was when I picked them to start the series, partially because, Boston already won one game. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing. Subscribing is great because this podcast, Real GM Radio, will never come out on a specific day of the week. It's my availability, guest availability, events of the league. So you can't get in the habit of, it's Thursday, I should go. It's not always going to be anything like that. And you can also help other people find the show. That is leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast player, word of mouth, in person, social media, whatever you're going to do. And also, extremely importantly, it is checking out our sponsors. For us, that is BetOnline. Use that CLNS50 promo code, which most importantly for you, gets you a 50% welcome bonus on your initial deposit. And it also tells them that you came from us. And so hopefully they will continue to advertise on this fair podcast, and that will be useful for me and for the show continuing and everything else. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On and Dunked On Prime, with Nate Duncan. Those are going really well, and we're of course doing in-depth breakdowns of every game, but also we're deep in our off-season previews, and we will be starting our draft work soon. I've gotten going on that. I'm through the top, I don't know if they'll be my top four guys, and I'm working now a little bit lower on the catalog, and we'll be talking about that probably on Real GM Radio at some point, but also of course on Dunked On. And we are doing Spotify Live. That is typically Tuesdays at 6 Eastern, 3 Pacific. A lot of fun. It's kind of like a call-in radio show that is then released as a podcast roughly 24 hours later on Spotify. And then we do Playback, which Playback is really cool single-screen experience where basically you input your streaming or cable provider, and considering a lot of them have ABC, who's doing the finals, it should be pretty doable. And then you single-screen, so that means our call and the game are the same. And if you want some audio from that feed, if you want some audio from us, you can set those levels yourself. There's also a very nice discussion section. We take questions during the stoppages. So it's a impressive technological achievement that we're thrilled to be a part of. Also, my written work is at The Athletic. Did an extender trade piece about a week ago, and then I have a bunch of things in the offing kind of related to setting up the offseason and everything else. So those aren't out yet. I'm in that stage where I'm writing like three things and none of them are ready to publish, but they will be. And so you can keep an eye on that. If you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. I try to reply. I am not the greatest at that. That's why that's not what I promised to do. But thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.